From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last night at a family dinner table. A parent, tired of feeling like they couldn't understand their teenager's actions, looked across the table and said, "What's wrong with you lately?" And the teenager, tired of feeling like the parent didn't care, replied, "What's wrong with me? Why don't you figure out what's wrong with you?" and stormed away. That is a familiar and painful scene. Parents raising children lovingly, then watching them change dramatically during the teenage years. Mixed into the occasionally rocky relationship, parents worry about drug use, sex, addiction to technology, poor choices, and academic stress is a serious problem for many teenagers. We've covered it on this program, with increasing pressure to perform on standardized tests and impress colleges. Well, Dr. John Duffy is a clinical psychologist and the author of a book called The Available Parent. You might have heard him on NPR. Tonight, he's a guest at the Pittsford PTSA. It's a 7 p.m. free event at Calkins Road Middle School. But first, he's my guest for the hour right here on Connections. And John, it's great to have you in studio.
Thanks, Evan. It's really, really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
A lot to talk about and the people who helped bring him here. Jory Sincotta is the Pittsford District PTSA co-president. Jory, great to have you.
Thanks for having us.
And Trish Blake Jones is Pittsford Mendon High School PTSA co-chair. Trish, nice to have you as well. And I want to welcome my colleague Gene Fisher back to the studio for a brief moment to say hello. We are running out of time on Pledge Week, Gene.
We are. We're actually a little more than 24 hours away from the end of our membership campaign. We've got a ways to go on the goal. Not impossible, but it certainly needs your support to make it happen. So I'm going to keep this brief because, again, we've got a great conversation. And coming up to that conversation, I just want to say I'm so thankful that I am not a teenager these days, and I'm so thankful that I'm not raising a teenager these days based on how bad I was when I was a teenager. So if you're thinking, you know, this is going to be great because I'm raising a teenager or my child is raising a teenager and there are going to be some great tips here, you have enough time to make your pledge of support to keep this kind of programming continuing and get back and not miss a moment of the conversation. Because when you support WXXI, your public radio station, or WEOS in Geneva, or WRUR in Rochester, you are, number one, voting with your wallet, so to speak, and saying that I think that this kind of civil discourse and this kind of critical, urgent information needs to be available every day, all the time, to everybody that wants it. And you can make a choice of saying, you know, maybe $5 a month or $10 a month, maybe a one-time gift of $50 or $100, maybe a gift of $10 is right for you. You can go to your website. You can go to WXXI.org/give. If you're listening on WEOS, you can use our website there, WEOS.org. In Rochester, WRUR.org works as well. You can call 1-800-295-9994. Talk to one of our great volunteers. But we'd really like for you to make that vote of confidence today and sort of that request for great, important, critical, crucial information for our society that comes to you every day on your public radio station. So thank you, and just repeat those websites one more time, WRUR.org, WEOS.org, or WXXI.org, and thanks.
Thank you, Gene. A couple quick housekeeping notes here. We get a lot of books pitched to this program, and there's a lot of parenting advice out there, and we say no to most of it. This is one that I read and thought that it is timely, and it is really differentiates itself from the rest in many ways that I think we can relate to, and we're going to work through this hour. And then the second note is this. On a very serious note, we've had some listeners who saw the tease for this program who are wondering if we're going to explore questions about teenagers and gun violence. That's not what the book's about. Dr. Duffy's not here to psychoanalyze those tragic cases. But on behalf of the listeners who wanted to know more about that, I'll just ask Dr. Duffy this. Do you look at those cases, do you find yourself wondering about the background, the home life, or are those such outliers that they're sort of outside the scope?
It's the trickiest thing, Evan, because, you know, we like to think that there's going to be some nice, clean profile, and we're going to be able to target the kids who are going to perpetuate the violence. I was a new psychologist back in the Columbine days, mm-hmm. and I remember we were rallying in my field and in the police department field, most every field, to find the trench coat mafia, to identify those kids. Yeah. And even now, I feel like we're the tail chasing the dog in terms of the wake of the mass shootings. And it's important, I think, to have a really open discourse with a lot of different fields, a lot of different people, recognize with humility, we don't know exactly what's going to happen here or how this works, but I sincerely believe that if there were early intervention with school psychologists and social workers and people who met these kids when they were young and recognized, okay, these are some troubled kids. How are we going to address their needs? If we were able to address their needs when they were young before they did the awful things that they did and that certainly merit punishment, then I think we're heading in the right direction, okay, regardless of where we go in terms of gun control.
And then the separate question, somewhat related, was some listeners wanted to know, I have no idea on the breakdown of these cases of these kids if they are on the different medications, drugs out there, but we had some listeners who wanted to know if you think, are we over-medicating, generally speaking?
The answer is yes. I'm not sure it has anything to do with this issue.
I think we need a lot more research.
Absolutely.
Okay. The book is called The Available Parent, and it opens with John mentioning the fact that you hate your phone.
Yeah, I hate my phone.
Can you tell us why you hate your phone?
I hate my phone because when I was a kid, phone attached to the wall, and when I hang up that phone, I'm off the grid. Now, my phone is in my pocket as I speak, and there's some buzz in the back of my head saying, well, as soon as I got off the phone, off the air here with Evan, I'm going to check that phone because probably some texts and some emails and some business waiting for me.
I'm actually texting, or I'm checking it while we speak because that's part of my job, so I'm with you on that.
Right. So I think it's this grand distraction from life, right? Yeah. And there are a lot of good things about the smartphone. But for me, yeah, I really dislike the phone. I think it's a necessary evil in our lives these days. I don't think we're going to go backwards technologically, but I think we have to find a way, and I'm hoping there's a backlash sociologically in the near future that brings us back to face-to-face interpersonal contact as opposed to this kind of distant, remote contact via texting, sexting, social media, and whatever.
I am an optimist on that. I said on this program yesterday when we talked about social media that I think we're still in the infancy or the end of the infancy as a species in when you've got a phone and you can do everything with it. It's still a new toy, but I think we're figuring out now that you can overuse it. Maybe I'm just totally naive and ignorant, but I'm hoping that we're going to gear back a little bit. But John covers a lot of angles, including technology in this book. And we're going to get to that in just a second. But first, let's define a term, available. Define the term available.
Yeah. I fought for this term with my publisher who said, hey, this doesn't mean anything to anybody but you. But the idea behind availability is I find that parents way too often parent from a place of fear. And so I encourage parents to be more present and available with their kids and put their fear and their judgment and ego aside as best they can and be present, recognizing that the connection with my kid, that's where my power lies. It doesn't matter what technique I'm using as a parent. If I'm connected, if there's a good ratio of positive to negative interactions, things are going to go more smoothly. And that's what availability is, being present for your kid, protecting some time every day for them. You know, for your unconditional positive regard of them, looking them in the eye, asking them about their day without distraction.
Yeah, present doesn't mean sitting directly next to them because, as you write, you can sit next to your child and not be present and available as well.
Oh, it happens all the time.
Often because of the phone.
Yeah. Often because of the phone. And, you know, a lot of us like to think what you're referring to, Evan, is my kid being on the phone all the time. But the truth of the matter is, just as often, it's us, the parent.
I feel it, and I fight it. I have a 3.5-year-old. He'll say, put your phone in your pocket. He'll say it. He started saying that at 2.
Is that right?
And I don't think that I don't want the audience to think I'm on it all the time with them. But once in a while, you find yourself fighting for that moment where, do I take this work call or not? And then he'll let you know. And I'm totally aware of it. And I actually am glad that I've got a kid who's saying that to me to reinforce that. Because I'm reading John's book and I'm feeling that there's a difference between present physical and present available.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we confuse this all the time. Smart, loving, well-intentioned parents miss this mark all the time. I'm available. I'm right there. I drive into classes and I help them with homework. But if you're not, if you're harsh or criticizing or judging and your ego has a lot to do with your connection with your kid in that moment, you're not really available. If your phone, your emails are a distraction, no way you're available in that moment.
Here's another thing that The Available Parent, the book kind of reinforced for me. If there's a conventional wisdom out there about when the communication breakdown and that relationship breakdown seems to happen in the teenage years, a lot of parents think, boy, my kid's changing. They're changing hormonally. There's societal influence, all of these things happening, and they're the ones who became unavailable. And John says parents are often the first ones to become less available, and the kids follow that.
This took me a little while to get to know and to learn, and I learned it from kids. So they would say, oh, yeah, I'm surly. I'm mean to my kids, but they were surly first. I could tell they pulled away first, and I could tell that they were judging me. They needed me to be something other than what I was. They needed me to press harder in order for me to be okay with them. And so they recognize that as unavailability, and kids kind of respond in kind. It's a self-protective measure. In a way, when I hear a kid tell it, I think, well, good for you. That's not a bad way to protect yourself from an unavailable parent.
Interesting. And so when you talk to parents, do you try to kind of put that directly in front of them saying, because they probably are coming to you saying, hey, isn't there a problem with my kid? Eh? And you might have to tell them. They're responding to your lack of availability.
Right.
How's that go?
It is, it's probably the diciest part of my practice, to be perfectly honest with you, is to let the parents know, because oftentimes it's Jiffy Lube therapy. I drop my kid off, you fix my kid, then we're gone, right? but the truth of the matter is that therapy with a teenager is a family issue, right? And so I don't think it's right to just say, you know, mom and dad, this is your problem. But you're definitely playing a role in it. And it's important to breathe, calm down, and recognize the role you play so that you can make some changes in your own behavior and your kid will respond in kind.
Now, you also have a problem with the way our society talks about teenagers in general.
I do.
You feel like they are among some of the most disparaged as a group people out there. And we talk about them as if they are all petulant, immature, self-centered, lazy, et cetera. All those teenagers these days. You hear parents say, and I'm sure and anyone listening to this right now has heard somebody say, just got to get our son or daughter out of the teenage years.
Yeah,
and just hear it all the time. As if the teenagers are automatically awful.
Precisely, you know, right? If we could just get to 18 or 21 or whatever we consider the end of adolescence, right, we're going to be okay. But the truth of the matter is I've got a weird job. I've known 400 teenagers over the course of the past, you know, 20 years, and I've yet to meet one where I thought, yeah, I'm not too impressed with this kid. I think they are petulant. I think they are angry. I think they're incredibly egocentric. I think they're ruining the language with their texting and their LOLs. And the truth of the matter is, not once have I felt that. This is a loving, caring, thoughtful generation. I think in a lot of ways, bullying is going to be a thing of the past because of the way that these kids operate with one another. They actually designate drivers. You know, unlike I can honestly say my generation did, they take a lot of social issues to heart. A lot of things are changing societally, in part because of people under 30. And so I think the bad rap that teenagers today have is completely unearned.
The Onion had an article recently. Now, The Onion is not a real news source, but a lot of people shared it that said 13-year-old girl. Brain-dead 13-year-old girl who is only able to text and roll her eyes, taken off life support. The idea being characterizing these teenagers as all they want to do is text. They're not really emotionally connected. They're really brain-dead. And a lot of people thought that was funny. I know it was not all that serious, but does that contribute to the stereotype of teenagers, John?
It definitely contributes to the stereotype. And I think we might over-focus on the texting as to kind of the death of the language and the death of really communicating with people. But we can't really blame our kids for that, right? They were brought up with this stuff, and this is the way they communicate, and it's very important to them. And the truth of the matter is, with texting and with social media, our kids communicate with each other more than probably we did a generation ago. We might not like the method by which they communicate, because we espouse this face-to-face kind of deep communication. But it's better than nothing, and there's a lot of it. And our kids don't just text. It's important to them to be with their friends physically in space. That's not all they do. And I think as parents and as our generation, we tend to forget that at times.
You tell a story in your book about a father who was struggling with this, and you advised him to try texting his daughter, I think, twice a day, just two texts a day, but positive, even basic, and just to see what would happen. And the results were pretty interesting.
Yeah. I actually talked to that father a couple of weeks ago, so this is a pretty opportune time to talk about that. And he's still, now his daughter is out of college. This goes back several years. And he still texts her a couple of times a day, and every once in a while he gets, I love you back. Or, you know, yeah, I saw that on TV last night. I agree. That was really funny. Or, you know, here's a link to this song I really like. I think you're going to like it. So their communication is being fostered and strengthened through texting. So a lot of parents are very resistant to texting. No, I'm not going to do that with my kid. I refuse to join into something that I think is detrimental to them. But if you choose not to do that, I sincerely think as parents, you're really missing the boat and a strong opportunity to connect.
Parents in the room, Jory, how many texts a day? Your kids, how many kids do you have?
I have four children.
Four
and
kids.
My oldest actually turns 13 on Sunday, so I am just entering the teenage years.
We could probably do a whole other hour on when do you get them a cell phone, and I don't even want to think about that. And everyone's going to have a different answer, and I'm not here to say there's a right or wrong, but 13-year-old
has a cell phone? I have a 13-year-old, and then she has two younger sisters who are going to be 12, and they all just got their first cell phones.
Okay.
Because they're in middle school now, so it's kind of that rite of passage, and for parents, like you were, you know, to be able to communicate with them.
How many texts a day?
It depends on the day. They don't use their phones as often as probably older teenagers do, because they're new, and they're just kind of getting with it, and a lot of their friends.
Change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a lot of their friends don't have phones yet either. But depending on how often I'm with them, so I still have a lot of face-to-face time with my children, but there are days like today, for example, where I won't see them at all, and I will pointedly at least text them once, if not twice today, just to touch base and see where they're at and see if they need anything.
Okay. Trish, how many kids?
I have two children, a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old.
How many texts a day do you think they're sending?
But to me or
just
to them?
In general, how many texts a day do you
infinite.
Think they're sending?
Infinite
uncountable numbers? Does it blow your mind?
It doesn't matter anymore because it is a way that we communicate together.
Okay.
All the time. That's how I talk to my kids.
When you started that process, did you think, I'm not a texter?
Not so much.
No? Okay. Nope. Okay.
I was fine with it because I understood the power that it had. If you could get them to respond. And over time, they've gotten better and better because they think it's a good way to do it.
All right. Now, John, for the parents out there who say, okay, I text my kids and at times I get no reply. Is that acceptable?
Right. You know, I think it's important to lay down the groundwork. I mean, we're paying for these devices, right? And a big part of it for parents is, hey, health and safety are at issue and this thing can help me ensure that my kid is safe. So I think it is reasonable for parents to lay down the expectation that when I text you, you respond to me on a timely basis. And I've had kids in my office say, oh, you know, I'm really sorry, Mom, my phone died or I didn't get your text. I can't remember believing that one time.
Right.
You know, because they get all their friends' texts and they probably respond within a very, very short period of time. So, yeah, I think it's an important thing to be able to do. The iPhone, the smartphone, is a great health and safety tool for parents. And I think we'd be missing an enormous opportunity if we didn't use it like that.
My guests for the hour are Dr. John Duffy, who you're hearing there now. He's a clinical psychologist, and his book is The Available Parent. It's available now. And he is going to be at Calkins Road Middle School tonight, 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public, 7 p.m. at Calkins Road Middle School. And he's a guest of the Pittsford School District, the PTSA. Jory Sincotta is Pittsford District PTSA co-president. She's here. And Trish Blake Jones is Pittsford Mendon High School PTSA co-chair. So they helped bring John Duffy here. I should mention, I'm getting comments online. I should have mentioned the phone number if you want to join the program. I'm not the only parent with questions. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I want to get to our first question, which was texted to me by Jake. Jake writes, I hope your guests talk about the difference between spouses. Not infrequently, the parent that is more available is not the one that spends the most time with the kids. Any tips on managing that without being overly confrontational would be appreciated.
Yeah, good question, Jake. Yeah, you know, balance between parents is really important and a consistent message of availability between parents is really important too. So the first discussion that I would encourage you to have is a meeting of the minds between mom and dad, and talk about the vibe you want to put out as parenting, as parents, and you know, and what you want your kids to get out of your parenting, and relative to texting and social media and things, the more you're on the same page going into it, I think the better off you are going to be. And I can't tell whether you're the more available parent or the less available parent, but it doesn't much matter. What's important is that you both have some degree of availability to your kids at least some moments of every single day. And if you can accomplish that, things in your world with your kids will be smoother in the times that are going smooth, and you can enjoy them more. And when things are not going so well, things will feel more resilient. The more you and mom are on the same page, the far better things are going to go.
Parents, or even those who are not parents, if you want to join the conversation as we talk about the much maligned group of teenagers, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I was struck by a section of the book about parents' approach to kids and their sexuality and children who are gay. And I want to, first of all, listen to a brief clip because I'm reading John's book right at the time where someone shared, and I hadn't seen it before. It's an NPR StoryCorps story. It actually came out a year ago. And it's the story of a man who is now almost 70 years old, 1959. He was 15 years old. And so he's 71. 1959, he was 15. And he describes a scene in which his father, who was sort of the hardscrabble farmer, you know, one of these farmers who's always got dirt under their fingernails and worn hands and always working. Well, his dad had to pop into school, and he was embarrassed that his dad had manure-covered jeans. And he tells the story of his conversation that happened later with his father. Now, he'd never discussed his homosexuality with his father, but this is the story that this man tells now about what happened in 1959.
My father says to me, I was walking down the hall this morning, and I saw a kid that looked a lot like you ducking around the hall to avoid his dad, but I know it wasn't you because you would never do that to your dad. And I squirmed in my seat, and I finally busted out, and I said, well, Dad, did you have to wear your cow crap jeans to my assembly? And he said, look, everybody knows I'm a dairy farmer. This is who I am. And he looked me square in the eye. And then he said, now how about you? When you're a full-grown man, who are you going to go out with at night? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I think you do know. And it's not going to be that McLaughlin girl that's been making goo-goo eyes at you, but you won't even pick up the damn telephone. And I'm going to tell you something today, and you might not know what to think of it now, but you're going to remember when you're an adult, don't sneak. Because if you sneak like you did today, it means you think you're doing the wrong thing. And if you run around and spending your whole life thinking that you're doing the wrong thing, then you'll ruin your immortal soul. And out of all the things a father in 1959 could have told his gay son, my father tells me to be proud of myself and not sneak.
I was really moved by that passage, that story, and that's 1959. And yet, you read John Duffy's book and you hear stories of parents who are still, trying to figure out, what do I say? Do I say nothing? I was struck by the story in the book of a 16-year-old girl saying, well, my parents have never even brought it up. Are they ever even going to bring it up? But John, if you're a parent, you may think certain things and you may love them. What do you say? So first of all, let me just back up and say, were you moved by this? I was really moved by that story. I thought that was amazing.
It's a beautiful story, and it speaks to kind of for a very open and available parent, especially when you consider the time.
1959.
My goodness, right? If that happened, if you told me that it was a week ago, I'd still be blown away by the story. It's lovely, and it speaks to kind of that authenticity, and he's trying to draw that from his son, and that unconditional regard to have for your kid, regardless of who they are, to accept your child for who they are. And if you're going back, more than 50 years, and you can say that you gave that gift to your child, that is an enormous, almost breathtaking gift.
Now, when it comes to parents who are struggling with Do I broach the subject? Do I let them know? You know, there are parents out there who may think, I think my child is gay. I don't know. Do I tell them if you are, it's okay, but what if they're not? And I'm sure you've had these conversations. You bring it up in the book. You've also talked to kids who are almost frustrated. Their parents seem afraid to bring it up. So that's never easy, right?
It's a difficult thing to bring up. I think parents are very anxious. Like with some other things, I think they think, you know, boy, if I bring up the issue of whether or not my child is gay or not, they're going to really start considering whether they are. And maybe there's some power of suggestion and there's some anxiety about that. As most of us know, at a point of calm when it's not our kid, well, you know, your child is either gay or he or she is not gay. And bringing it up only gives them permission to talk about it, you know. And there's never a time, rarely a time, where your parent needs you more to be present and available for them than if you are carrying something like that around and it's a secret, because it can feel like a dark and shameful secret if it's not something that we can talk about openly in a family. And imagine the burden you lift from your kid when you say, you know what, we're going to talk about sexuality. This is going to be awkward, but I want to know where you are. I want to know what you feel. I want to know who you're drawn to. And you can tell me anything, you know. It might be a very difficult thing to ask of yourself, but if you kind of work from a compass of availability, it's the only reasonable thing to do.
Let's get a short break, and we're going to come right back with John Duffy, the author of The Available Parent. He is in town tonight. He's a guest of the Pittsford PTSA, 7 p.m. at Calkins Road Middle School. It's a free event and open to the public. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about something that kind of turned an idea on its head for me. We talk a lot about hookup culture. We worry about our kids. We worry about teenagers. John writes about how seriously they take intimacy or not. And certain things might surprise you as well. So that and much more coming up next with John Duffy. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, it's Unleashed First Hour. We're talking about our animals, our pets, taking your phone calls and questions with special reports and more. Then second hour, it's Second Opinion. It's a look at today's CPR. Public television is teaching all of America CPR. The new guidelines are out. How has CPR changed? We'll also look about questions about supplements in the wake of a new study. Talk with you Friday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2016 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. That familiar voice you just heard is with me in studio. It's Jean Fisher. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Evan, and hello, everyone. Hello, guests, and thank you so much for being here. This has been just a fascinating conversation, and I think probably a little difficult because I can't imagine, you know, how hard it must be to go up to your teenager and bring up difficult topics and, you know, not know. It's like lawyers always say, never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. But, you know, as I'm listening and I'm thinking, where else are you going to hear this kind of a conversation? You'll hear a great conversation this evening at
Calkins Road Middle School.
Thank you very much. And you'll hear, of course, a great conversation every day here on Connections. And it's because, as Evan was saying, you know, you doing it for an hour, you have to really know what you're talking about to sit for an hour and talk about something, and you don't really have that anywhere else. A conversation like this on another station would probably go for maybe 5 minutes, then there'd be a couple of commercials, then it would go for 5 minutes, and there'd be a few more commercials. The only way that we can bring you this kind of a conversation on such an important topic is because listeners like you call in a pledge, go online and make a pledge, come to the lobby and drop off an envelope with a check in it, or, you know, there are people that remember WXXI in their wills, or they make, you know, gifts of stock and things like that. But today, right now, during this membership campaign, we're asking for you to consider a membership gift of maybe $5 a month, $10 a month, maybe a one-time gift of $50 or $25 or $100. Think about the information and the knowledge that you are gaining in this hour of Connections, and put a price tag on it, put a value on it, and then go. You can call us right now. It's 1-800-295-9994. or you can go on the web and make your gift there. You can go to WEOS.org. You can make your gift there listening to WEOS. You can go to WRUR.org. You can go to WXXI.org. And all of it, because it's time-stamped right now, is going to say, you know, we're supporting connections. We are supporting this important program that takes the whole hour to talk about the issues, not interrupt it every couple of minutes for advertisement. And that's a good thing. It's good to have an hour to really talk about a topic. So you know what? I'm going to let you guys get back to it. And thank you.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you. Well said. All right. Let's continue the conversation. I'm not the only parent who has questions for John Duffy. We're going to try to get through as many of yours as we can. And all of a sudden, we have a virtual flood of them online and our first phone call. So let me grab a caller on the line. This is Judy in Brighton. Go ahead, Judy.
Yes, I'm a grandmother, and I'm fortunate enough to have my grandkids close by. And I got my smartphone about the same time as my 15-year-old grandson got his. And luckily, I was able to figure out how to text not quite a step ahead of him. He shows me a lot. But I do interact with them like that. And I just wanted to make that comment that it can extend beyond just parents.
Very good. Thank you, Judy. What do you think, John?
Bless you, Judy. That is a really, really good point. And every once in a while, I get the opportunity to address grandparents, and I really encourage them, hey, get on board this texting train, because my mother, who is not tech savvy at all, and she's got arthritis in her fingers, and texting is very difficult for her. But right now, my beloved Chicago Cubs are going deep in the playoffs, and she knows my son is excited about that. So she's taking advantage of that connection through texting, and she's getting feedback from him, and their connection is stronger than it was a month ago. So I think you're on the right track there, not just for parents, but for grandparents as well. Thank you.
Carolyn writes to the program. Two questions for John, and I'll start with this one. He says, how do you get your teenagers to spend time with you? They know we are available for them, but they just don't want to be with us. It's a hard adjustment. Both my kids, age 12 and 14, just want to spend time in their bedrooms. We used to make them do their homework at the dining room table, but now they do it upstairs. We do eat dinner together every single night, but is it okay to see them for 15 minutes a night?
Okay, let's talk about this for a minute, Carolyn. I get that you spend time with your kids, and I think that's great. Oftentimes, when parents tell me that, when I really dismantle what they're telling me, effectively they spend time for disseminating an agenda or a lecture to their kids. So, you know, there's a difference between, hey, let's hang out and talk about the music you love, and, hey, I'm really not very happy with the amount of homework you're doing or that your room's not clean. So that's one thing I want you to keep in mind is, what are you talking about and when you spend time with your kids? Like we said earlier, you can spend a lot of time with people and not really, really be available to them. So let yourself have some time, a lot of time, where you're just enjoying your kids. I often ask parents also, you said your kids are kind of upstairs and they disappear up into their bedrooms and things. To the extent that you can reverse that, and I know a lot of us are reluctant to do that because our kids want their room set up and they want computers and iPads and phones up in their rooms, but I have a strong bias, if you can, in favor of bringing everything downstairs so that things are real communal, and then you have these kind of organic opportunities to connect about things that might surprise you, just like driving in the car. Wow, what do you like about Kanye West, you know? Allow yourself those opportunities by taking some of that activity out of their rooms and downstairs.
Okay, so I got to ask the Kanye question because I remember in your book, the Ozzy concert, right? Yeah. So there are some kids who think, I don't ever want to go to a concert with my parent. No way. And yet there are others. I have a friend who took her daughter to Toronto to surprise her for a Taylor Swift concert. And the pictures they have together, they're having the greatest time. Now, is mom a huge Taylor Swift fan? Probably not. But they had a great time together. In your book, you tell the story of going to an Ozzy concert,
yes,
if I remember correctly.
You are correct.
And you know, I don't think that was probably mom's favorite music, but did it. So how do you differentiate, you know, saying, I want to know what you love and I'm interested, and the kid says, that I don't want to talk about Kanye with you. I don't want to talk. No. But, you know, work me through some of that.
Right. Okay. So a lot of parenting today, we take dead seriously, right? You know, what colleges are you going to get into? How much homework are you doing? What's wrong with these kids you're hanging out with? Sometimes you can be playful with your kids, and music is probably my favorite area in which to play, right? The mom that you are talking about, Evan, had no interest in going to see an Ozzy Osbourne concert. She hated the idea, but she was savvy enough to recognize, you know, if I'm willing to do this, I'm guessing my kid's going to open up a little bit to me. And if I'm playful about this and I'm fun and I really kind of get into it a little bit, I think I am really investing in the future. And I really do think that pays dividends. And another spot in the book, after that, I came across a really clever father who loved music and his son loved music, but their musical tastes, there was a gulf between them. So what they did is they took turns picking concerts. So for every, you know, rap concert or Radiohead concert that this kid went to, he was going to hear some folk music with his dad. And in the end, they both liked both kinds of music. And it was a point of connection for them. And it was at least something to debate and talk about. And before then, they had nothing in the bank account between them. And they were totally unavailable to one another. And music brought them together.
All right. Well, let me ask the parents in here. Would your kids ever want to go to concerts with you guys? Do you go to concerts with your kids, Trish?
No, I don't go to concerts with my kids. But I do share a love of music with my son. We like the same kind of music, and I like anything that's contemporary and new, that isn't bad rap. So So interesting, John. That is a connection I've made with my son, and it's taken us miles.
Wow, Jory?
Yeah, mine. We like the same kind of music, so that is a connection. But we don't go to a lot of concerts. What connects my children with me is a love of theater. So we talk about plays, and they are in plays, and I involve myself in that way. And you know, we're waiting for Oz. You know, the Wicked to come back to our area, because we're, you know, that's on our bucket list to do together.
So, have you seen it yet?
I have, but they were really too young at the time that I went to see it. And so they know that, and we talk about that. And anytime something comes up about that, that's a point of connection for us.
Okay, before I get back to Carolyn's second question, which I think a lot of parents will relate to on her second question, before I go there, I'm reminded of when John talks about music being able to build connection. Some parents use sports to build connection. He also tells a story in his book about a father, I think, who was a big football player growing up. His kid's good, but his kid never really revealed, I don't really want to do it. I'm kind of doing it because I'm kind of supposed to. And the fact that I think outside of that relationship within football, there wasn't much. And I've heard from parents on this program, I've talked to my older brother's got two young boys, 13 and 12, and they feel like it can't just be one travel league. They've got to be in three travel leagues. It feels like it's all we do. We barely have time to do anything else. It creates strain, and it goes from something extracurricular and fun to feeling like work. And parents are really fighting with that right now, John. What do you say to
this? This is a very difficult, really important concept, right? If things were not kind of cranked up to 11, where you had to be hyper involved, then parents and kids could relate to, hey, I love your soccer league. I like being a coach, and we're doing it once in a while, and that's great. And maybe we can watch some soccer on TV and connect that way. But when it becomes this constant demand on both of our times, it creates disconnection and an amount of tension that probably is hard to calculate, but really creates rifts within families an awful lot of the time, unnecessarily, you know? So I think you bring up a really, really good point there. We do way, way, way too much. We expect too much. We press too hard. And a point of disconnection becomes, or a point of connection rather, becomes a point of disconnection very readily and way too easily.
But this is where I see a parallel between modern extracurricular sports and academics now. It's become this competition that, you know, kids feel a lot of pressure for standardized tests, college prep, things like that. Kids feel pressure that if I'm going to be in one soccer league, my nephew is 13 and he's in like three.
Yeah.
And he feels like, well, if I'm not on all the travel teams, then I'm losing ground.
Right.
And his dad, my brother, just wants him to be happy and not feel like you're overloaded. You know,
in a way, I think it's almost a cultural issue, because I think you're right. I think in order to be successful in soccer in high school, you have to have not just played soccer coming up on a team once a year, but you have to be playing constantly. I work with a lot of kids who play hockey, And hockey, it requires an enormous amount of time and energy and resources and money from families, and they invest so much in it. And then sometimes a kid will get to high school and not make the team. You know, we were talking about some of this earlier, where there's something systemic about the sports system that probably needs to change, because the pressure and the intensity and the potential for letdown on the back end, and a real dent in a sense of self-worth, is likely for an awful lot of kids who invest most of their young lives in one sport or another, you know? So I would love to see things kind of calm down a little bit. Kids have the ability to kind of try a couple of different sports early in their lives and become specialists a little bit as they get older, and let that be a little more organic and a little less pressed than it is now.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe that would cut down on the loudmouth parents we see at sporting contests.
Yes.
Carolyn also writes her second question for John Duffy, the author of The Available Parent, who's my guest for the hour. Carolyn says, we turn off our kids' Wi-Fi at 9, and they do not have phones. They say that they don't know any other parents that do that. Why not? Don't other parents want their kids to wind down before bed, not have screen time, and get a good night's sleep? They really dislike us for this, but we explain why we think it's important. Our 14-year-old feels like without social media access after 9, her friends have conversations and she feels excluded. What do we do?
Okay. So, first of all, in support of your point, Carolyn, I like the idea of turning off Wi-Fi in the house at a certain point in time. You know, our screens are hyper-stimulating. There's really good research out there right now to suggest that if we keep looking at those until the moment that we go to bed, we're going to sleep pretty poorly, right? So that's part of what you want for your kid, is you want some wind-down time, read a book, do something different than stare at that screen. In all fairness to your daughter, though, you know, there is that press that, man, if I put that phone down or if you turn off that Wi-Fi, I'm off the grid and the grid is going on without me. And so I'm missing something really critical and important to my social life. So at the very least, even if the rule stands, I think it's important to hear her out and let her talk about her anxieties about what's going to happen to me if that happens. If you're dismissive with her, then I think you're creating a rift of availability between you, and that might bleed into other areas of your life unnecessarily. So I am all for the rule. I like it a lot, but I also think you want to hear your child out about what impact it has on her, and maybe there's some point of negotiation where she can, you know, maybe touch base a little later, just for a little while, make sure, you know, that she can touch base with friends, and then she's back off the grid. But her point of view is important as something not to be dismissed, because she is coming from an honest point. She's not just trying to challenge your parenting. She means it when she says she has some anxiety about being off that grid and being off that phone.
Carolyn will relate in your book to the father who was concerned about the daughter who was having trouble sleeping, and he wanted to take the phone away because he felt like, you can't put it down. And by the way, I've been there. I have a hard time sometimes going to bed because I'm still checking work and checking email and things. And so John, in his book, tells the story of a father who said, you know, we're going to take the phone away to make sure you can get to sleep. Very well intended. Now, right or wrong, he ends up reading her text messages and is horrified. He finds out, this daughter that I thought was awesome sounds like a monster on these texts. What's going on here? Is this not a good kid? And So this brought up a couple of things for me. I don't know that kids are writing diaries like we used to. I don't really think so. Yeah, not really, right?
No.
So the old question on do you find your kid's diary and read it seems like it's obsolete. But going through text messages may be sort of a modern corollary to that. And you write about snooping. Snooping doesn't work, but there's a difference between the old school style snooping and social media monitoring. So first of all, read your kids' text messages and then react to that, yes or no?
I'm going to say no to that. So this dad stayed up. It's a great story and a terrifying story, because he got hold of his daughter's phone, started reading her text messages, was up all night, and had an emergency session with me the next morning saying, I think I've raised a monster. I don't know what to make of this. And my immediate point to him as he read to me a few of these texts was, first of all, you've put yourself in a really terrible spot, because now the part of the point is you've snooped. You've violated her trust, right? The other part is the horrifying comments that you're reading are way out of context, and you're not really cued into how kids communicate with one another today. And so you are making presumptions based on a language that you don't understand
very
well.
Inside jokes, things like that.
Yes, yeah. And so, you know, I think his kid is actually a really, really great kid who's just talking the way kids talk. And if we take it all out of context, we will create not just great anxiety for ourselves, but we're going to try to clamp down and control our kids, and they will push back harder, and we'll create a crisis that is wholly unnecessary.
Okay.
You know?
Now, when it comes to monitoring things that are essentially mostly public, things like Facebook posts, John is saying, yes, do that. And you even talked about whether you think that parents should have passwords.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think early on, I think it's important for parents to have passwords. This is where I think extended family can come in really handy. I have a niece who's 20 right now, but when she was 13 or 14, her aunts and me, her uncle, we all were friends with her. And so every once in a while, she would post something. She's going to be so mad at me if she hears this, but she would post something that was wildly inappropriate. And I would usually write as a comment to that post, okay, Grace, you've got 10 minutes. The clock starts now. And I reach out to mom and dad if you don't pull this post down in 10 minutes. And so there's firewalls that don't have to be mom and dad that can help to protect that child, because it's the Wild West, right? They don't always think, boy, I'm probably posting something that is going to look really bad or make it look like I need some help I don't need, or that I feel a certain way about something that I don't necessarily feel. So they need some guidance there. So early on, I say, yes, make sure your kids know that you're looking, and make sure you have their passwords, because it's really a health and safety issue. I could tell you horror stories, but trust me, it can be a very, very dangerous thing to let your kid loose in the Wild West of Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, yeah, without any guidance whatsoever.
Parents are concerned, understandably so, about sex. John writes in the book that most modern sort of advice about sex, a lot of books sort of and gloss over it because parents are uncomfortable with it. But because of access to imagery, pictures, I mean, I do remember, and John has an anecdote in the book, somebody mentions going through old dictionaries. I had a friend who did exactly that. And this wasn't that long ago, and the world's totally different now. So because of that, kids are exposed to sexual imagery, those kind of things, whether we like it or not, generally earlier. Here's the hopeful thing. A lot of parents think hookup culture, it's very loose, etc. You're saying that there is some hope that teenagers are taking intimacy somewhat seriously, yes?
I would argue that they take intimacy very seriously, actually. You know, they're very, very thoughtful, despite what you hear about who they're hooking up with and why, and what even hooking up means. You know, part of the dad who was looking at his dad's text, well, he had a definition of hooking up that his daughter meant something completely different. Mm-hmm. She meant literally getting together with a boy to, you know, have coffee or something, you know. So, but he was terrified. So it's important that we know the lingo and draw those connections exactly the way you're describing.
And so that respect for intimacy is a hopeful thing.
Yes.
But there's also a point where John writes about, as parents, you're going to set your own standards on your expectations. It's important to communicate them. You do write that you've never seen any research that says a firm line saying never have sex works. And we talked about abstinence-only education on this program. The history is not good with efficacy there, no?
No, the history is not good. Listen, I have never known a parent to regret talking to their kids openly about sex and sexuality. And this, a lot of parents, most parents I work with will tell me, I don't want to do that. It's awkward. I don't know how to do it. And oftentimes parents will say, will you do it for me? And I have to say, no, you're going to have, it's best coming from you. I will tell you that the way my son and I handled it is because media gives you every opportunity to talk about sex, right? You watch an episode of Friends, you watch a football game, no matter what you're watching, you're going to have some opportunity because sex is going to come up. So if there's something that I think is pertinent, I usually put it on pause and say, okay, awkward moment coming. You and I are going to start talking about sex right now. It'll take 3 minutes, and then we just have our moment. So you can bring an air of levity to that, but you have to talk to your kids about sex from an early age because they are hearing about it. They are exposed to it. It is the whole thing is in a machine in the palm of their hand right now.
Oh, we can be overly serious about it to our own detriment, though? You're saying we can laugh a little bit when we talk about it? We can acknowledge the awkwardness?
Yes. It's important. I think if you feel awkward, it's important to say so. Otherwise, what your kid does is they will just grit their teeth and wait out your lecture, and they won't take in a word you're saying.
You see, I didn't even get through what I really – all the things I wanted to get through with John, I couldn't get through all of them. There's a whole section on the book on what doesn't work when it comes to connecting with kids, building these relationships, why lectures never work, vicarious living never works, micromanaging never works, snooping never works, underestimating, blinders, judging, smothering, coddling. Those things don't work. John addresses them all in the book. And because we're down to our last minute, I'll just have to tell you that you can hear more tonight. 7 p.m. Calkins Road Middle School. It's a free event open to the public. And Jory Sincotta and Trish Blake Jones are two parents from Pittsford who helped bring John in. And I'll just give you the floor for just a few seconds. Jory and Trish, what are you excited? Why did you want to bring in John right here to this community now?
I read John's book in the summer of 2014. And as I was reading it, I kept saying, wow, I'm not available all the time. And in fact, I often use unavailability, at least up until that point, as a strategy to get my kids to do what I wanted them to do, to try and change their behavior that was worrying me or scaring me or angering me. And so I thought, if I'm getting this message from this book, I wonder how many other parents could use this message.
You've made some changes based on it. Have you found
Absolutely.
Them to be working?
Yes, I'm much more transparent with my kids.
Jory, 15 seconds. What do you think?
Yeah, same thing. Trish came to my co-president and I last year and presented the book, and we both aha moment. She has older children. I have younger children, and the timing could not have been better.
Don't you agree with me, though? Aren't there? There's so many books out there. They're kind of like milk toast.
This is a fantastic, easy read.
Usable information.
You'll almost never hear this kind of conversation on this program, but I really found it timely because of how much the world is changing. I'm a parent already from the time I was a teenager to now with a 3.5-year-old. Texting, sex, academic rigor, drugs, those are all different than they were. And John addresses it all. The book's called The Available Parent. It's available now. You can meet John tonight, and I appreciate you coming in and joining the conversation this afternoon, John. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Very good. Thanks to Val LaBanca, the engineer of this program. Thank you, Val. And thanks to Megan Mack, the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you so much for supporting member-supported public radio.